Yeah, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's the
billiard room.
Come on already. We call it the
place to be.
Yes, the place to be. The place to be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can.
Ugh. Time to play the game!
No, you left me satisfied and smiling. So.
That's what she said.
So why do I want this? I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Place to be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
Japanese band Oral Vampire produced a song called The Repo Man and used footage.
Oral Vampire, huh?
Or Oral. A-U-R-A-L. What kind of show is this?
Sounds like some Twilight porn in Michael Lynch's collection there.
Oz went on to star in American Pie, of course, as the lacrosse player. Bismarck. No, wasn't it? Bismarck wasn't his
Lizmark.
Name? Lizmark. No, who's the other guy I'm getting confused with?
Bismarck. Yeah, he dressed as North Dakota.
There's only one place where the big boys play, and that is in my extra queen-size bed. Well, it just happens. What can you do?
Let's talk the things.
I think they might hit a shock wall.
Is that the Shockmaster's wall?
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. I'm just curious. PTB Nation, let me know what
you're
doing.
Our opener.
To do worse than Josh Richard. We getting you open with lyrical dope. And he's breath that I'm potent like an injectional dose. And it never quits. Taken from TS, a top terrorist. Rapper slash hijack a bombing tracks ever since I was young. I wasn't always big blind. It wasn't always as fine. Hey, yo, I rose from the slums. I had to pay my dues. Lay a few, but I ain't saying who. Staying true to the game, no names playing it cool. Just me and the crew, holding it down. Long as we round, we gonna keep socking it to you like Homie the Clown. Going down like Pop.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to another great episode of the One and Only Place to Be podcast. And welcome to the first episode of 2014. I'm your host, Justin Rosero. Joining me, as always, is the Man Cave here. Well, not in the Man Cave, not this weekend. Via Skype through the Man Cave, wiring. Scott Hayden.
Happy New Year, JR, and Happy New Year, Place to Be Nation. Welcome to episode 1 of 2014, but episode 281 overall.
This is our fourth calendar year recording, Scott.
I know.
11, 12, 13, 14.
Yes, it is. Absolutely. Amazing. Three-year anniversary coming up in about a month.
Crazy. So we have a really big show planned tonight, and we have some pleasantries, but we can get to those because you're going to be here this weekend, hopefully. And we're going to do a little mailbag, boozing, watching wrestling, kind of throwback.
Wrestling.
Sitting in the crib talking shit. So we already have a huge list of questions. But if you want to get in a mailbag question, go to the Place to Be Nation Facebook page. There's a post there. You can post it under there. And we're going to try and get through all those questions throughout the night. So, Scott, we can save a lot of our banter for Saturday because we have a loaded show we should get right into tonight.
Yes.
We have two guests from Pro Wrestling Only. They've both been on the show before. And we're going to dissect WCW 1994, the first half. We're going to go through Bash of the Beach, and then the back end, we're going to hopefully come back in a month or so and finish the back end of 1994. Before we do that, though, PlaceToBeNation.com, a lot of stuff going on. We have our epic piece up today. Chad Campbell spearheaded this, but it includes all of the staff and even a couple non-staff members, some friends of the site. It's the PTB Nation Wrestling Year in Review 2013. Chad kept throwing questions out there, Tag Team of the Year, Female Wrestler of the Year, Feud of the Year, TV Show of the Year, all kinds of stuff. Definitely worth checking out. And it's a conversational tone. So it's not a written piece like a normal year review. What we did is we just had a Facebook chat and we just pasted that chat in there for you. So there's a lot of banter, a lot of back and forth, some jokes, and a lot of cool answers to the questions. So definitely check that out. It's our year in review sitting on top of the page right now for you. Andrew Reich, as always, delivering the great college basketball content, looked at the mayor of Ames. Of course, the return of a local hero that rescued Iowa State basketball. So check that out. Another great piece. Andrew knows his basketball, obviously, very well did a great job there talking about Iowa State and their resurgence in the college basketball world. I also had the look back at PTB Nation 2013 from Brad Woodling. He went ahead and kind of called out some of the regular pieces and maybe a couple of other one-offs that we're really proud of here that we wanted to highlight for you. And just a way to catch you up. If you're new to the site, new to the podcast, you can go there. And Brad did a great job kind of directing you where to go on the site. If there's something you want to check out, we missed the 90s. We have all our MMA stuff, all our weekly recaps. Scott, you do Raw every week. And so we have SmackDown with Matt Petticord. Scott Keith does NXT. Ryan Everett with Main Event, Dan McGinn with Superstars. So all kinds of great reviews there for you. And of course, my Ring of Honor. And you can check out our full archive, all our pieces, sports, pop culture, wrestling, of course, all linked there from Brad. Our Place to Be Nation college football staff, Scott, you were part of this as well. Part three of the BCS Busters, 2004 to 2006, you went back and basically rebooked the college football championship as if there was a tournament in all those years. So this is the third part of the series. How many are there total, do you know?
Four.
Okay, so one more to come.
Yes.
And then, so that's cool. That's a good read. Actually, there's five, Scott. I think you missed that last one. We split into
two
pieces.
Yeah, that's right.
I think they did that
five.
After you submitted it. So, yeah. And of course, your Raw recap from December 30th is up with that very interesting ending. Maybe we can bullshit about this on this weekend as well on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel Bryan with the Wyatt family and whatnot, heading into the Rumble, of course. We're just a few weeks away. And, of course, Place to Be Nation will be en masse in Pittsburgh for that. I think we have 19 to 20 of us going, so should be fun. And we'll give a shout-out to Parv quick. He has his latest installment of Doctor Who up there as well. So lots of stuff, placetobenation.com, pop culture, sports, TV, movies, MMA, comics. Don't forget the comics, tons of that there. Gaming, music, and life, anything you could want. If you're interested in writing, just hit us up at info@placetobenation.com. You can submit a sample, and we'll check it out, and we'll get right back to you. And you can also leave feedback for us at Twitter at @place2bnation and on Facebook at facebook.com/place2bnation as well. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your loved ones, tell your pets, tell your children, tell everyone. Visit place2bnation.com. So, Scott, why don't we take a really quick break?
Mm-hmm.
And when we come back, we'll bring in our guests and we'll get to 1994 WCW.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What I'd like to have right now.
Chad, do you ever feel that the world revolves around WWF?
I think you mean WWE there, Parv.
Yeah, whatever, but what about David Crockett?
He likes it!
Well, what about Jimmy Valiant?
I'm gonna get y'all until I get you, Paul Jones. Oh.
The Four Horsemen.
We are a family, and we are the best!
The Omni, the Dangerous Alliance.
Please welcome the newest members of the Dangerous Alliance, Arn Anderson and Larry Zbysko.
Jim Cornette and the Midnight Express.
The Fantastics are putting the U.S. Tag Team title on the line against the Midnight Express.
Main events with actual work rate in them.
Woo! 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 All right!
It's just not fair to Flair.
It's not fair for Flair.
If this is what you're looking for, please check out Where the Big Boys Play podcast, the only pure NWA and WCW supercard podcast out there.
While you were in Hollywood making movies, Thunderlips, I was winning world titles.
Well, there they are, our good friends Chad and Parr, Where the Big Boys Play. Now, if you want nonstop old-school NWA discussion, getting back to that very first Starcade, these guys have it covered. Even the PICs have made an appearance once. We are very particular what podcasts we visit. So check out our friends Chad and Parr, Where the Big Boys Play. Their link is right on our site, placetobenation.com. Just go into the podcast menu. And there they are, with the other great shows we partner with. Chad and Parr, working Where the Big Boys Play. Speaking of Place to Be Nation, that's your everyday home for your pop culture needs. At placetobenation.com, we have everything. Wrestling, sports, comics, even polls. We want your opinions as well. Every day, there's something different with our top staff of writers who are experts in all fields of pop culture. From the weekly Raw review to the return of the hack, you've got everything you need. We're also working with a myriad of great podcasts, of course, besides Chad Parr. We have Grapple Talk, the fans podcast, Off the Top Rope, Answering the 10 Count, We Found New Music, and the Kings of Sport with Nate Milton. We've got everything for your listening pleasure. So check us out every day of the week at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Now, don't forget about our good friend Graham Cawthon and the history of WWE.com. He's still the top source for all argument solvers, from match results to house show cards to pay-per-view histories. Any questions you need answered, any debates among wrestling fans that need ending, head over to Graham's treasure trove of information. You will certainly find it. Need to know what the opener of Starrcade 1995 was? What was the main event of that 1988 Boston Garden house show you went to when you were 11 years old? Graham can tell you. He has WWE, WCW, ECW results, and the growing results in TNA and Ring of Honor. So for all your wrestling research needs, check out Graham Cawthon at thehistoryofwwe.com. Now finally, if you want a place to just hang out, discuss all things wrestling with fellow diehard fans, check out the news and the great forums at twfnews.com. They have all the up-to-the-minute stories in WWE, TNA, and pretty much everywhere in between. They talk old school, Attitude Era, and even those hard-to-remember guys and shows like Waylon Mercy or In Your House Number 3. But check out all there is to see right on twfnews.com. WrestlingOnly.com.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly, longtime announcer with the WWE, now the voice of Ring of Honor Wrestling. No better place to be than right here on the Place to Be podcast. Make sure you tune in every week.
All right, Scotty, we are back from break and very excited. This is a show that's been in the works for quite a while. As we mentioned last show, Scott Keith was supposed to join us. His work schedule got a little jumbled up. He will be with us in a couple of weeks to talk SummerSlam 2001. But instead, here tonight, we have two members of the great ProWrestlingOnly.com message board. The first, you've heard him be here before with Scott Keith, back when we talked about, spring of 2001, I believe, right, in the world of wrestling. And that is Mr. Will himself. Welcome back, Will.
Hey, buddy. How you doing?
We're doing very well. Glad to have you back. And I know you've been looking forward to this one as much as we have. So
I'm amped.
And, of course, stepping in for Scott, we want to thank him for being flexible joining us here on short notice. Even though he talks to Will more than enough, we're going to put him through another 2 hours of torture here, and that is our buddy Charles. Charles, how you doing?
When you put it like that, no, I'm doing good. How are you?
Good, good. It's great to have you back here, and looking forward to talking some WCW. We know you guys are both big fans. And this is a really cool time period. I don't want to say forgotten, because I think, you know, dedicated fans and fans that really know their wrestling history know this is a great time period. And one with a lot of, you know, tumultuous goings on backstage, but perhaps the greatest stretch of in-ring product in the company history. We'll talk about that. So what we did is we all went back. We watched Super Brawl, Spring Stampede, Slamboree, and Bash at the Beach. We're going to cover that first 6 months. And then we're going to have you back on in a month or so, and we'll cover the back half of the year. So, Scott, why don't you reset the year for us as far as champions go? Who do we have on top here with the gold?
Okay. We'll start from the bottom and work our way up. The tag team champions were Mr. Knobs and Mr. Sags, the Nasty Boys, who defeated Marcus Alexander Bagwell and Too Cold Scorpio at Halloween Havoc 1993. Your world television champion was Lord Steven Regal, who defeated Ricky the Dragon Steamboat at Fall Brawl. Your United States champion was the great, stunning Steve Austin, who beat Dustin Rhodes in the 2 out of 3 falls match at Stockade. Your international heavyweight champion was Ravishing Rick Rude, who defeated Ric Flair. And then this was at the time when the NWA split off from WCW, so they had technically two belts. And your world champion was the aforementioned Ric Flair, who defeated Vader at Starrcade. So Ric Flair, Rick Rude, Steve Austin, Steven Regal, I got to use the saying that right now, Steven Regal, and the Nasty Boys were your belt holders heading into 1994.
And on the management perspective, I believe it's pretty much Eric Bischoff fully in charge, right, guys?
Yeah, Eric Bischoff was in charge. Ric Flair was actually the booker at this point.
Correct, okay. And so Bischoff had just, he had taken over when, like early 93, right, was when Watts was fired and he took over?
Yeah, I mean, there's actually, believe it or not, there's some interesting stuff with the timeline there, mm-hmm. because there is a time period when even Dave Meltzer has said no one really knows who was running WCW because they were just in such a state of flux all the time. So so it's hard to say, but yeah, I mean, generally speaking, he was the next VP after Watts.
All right, so now we head into Super Brawl here, the first major pay-per-view event of the year. Of course, the first in Starrcade in 93, and what Scott had mentioned, Ric Flair defeated Vader to regain the world title for the first time in a couple of years. And he was reigning on top here heading into the new year. The Albany Civic Center in Albany, Georgia, my Rhode Island accent kicking in, Super Bowl IV. And let's go match by match here quick, and we'll go, you know, we'll touch on some, and we'll get deep into others. I know that Will had a lot to say about some of these guys. So why don't we start with Harlem Heat, then known as Cole and Kane, kind of fresh off their global run, but a year and a half before that, defeated Thunder and Lightning in 947. Scott, I know Thunder and Lightning is a great WCF tag team, but I think this is a different version. Will, why don't you give us some early thoughts on Harlem Heat here?
The Harlem Heat are what you think they are. Stevie Ray is absolutely horrible in this match. Booker T is serviceable, except he has the world's worst Macho Man elbow drop. And structurally, the match was fine. You know, it had the the early face shine, then the heels take over, and then kind of a crooked ending. But Christ, was the execution in this match horrible. So good structurally, horrible execution, and Stevie Ray absolutely sucks.
And that doesn't change for a long time, if ever. Charles, anything about Thunder and Lightning that you know? Did you think these guys had any kind of potential or any kind of future?
No. I don't know. I guess you could say they were electric, but I would have fun. Really, to me, honestly, my impression of this match was, you know, at this time, the WCW mat was blue and had the yellow logo on it, and it just was like, and then the teams were green, so it was like kind of yellow and blue making green. That because
Christ,
I think that's what they were going for, and they put the match together, so I guess they succeeded. Yeah. They're like, let's make the color palette look good out there.
So I mean, it was pretty disappointing.
And now Harlem Heat had a decent late 93, right? Because they were in the Fall Brawl match and everything like that. So it's not like there was some new team here. And it seems like they kind of de-pushed in early 94. It's the only time we see them on pay-per-view in the stretch we were reviewing here.
Yeah, I'm not really sure about that. I think you're probably right. I'm not sure why that changed.
When did they do the reboot? I don't know if any of you know, to Booker and Stevie. Because it might have been, maybe that's why they took them off TV for a bit and then they came back, perhaps, with the new names.
That was later in the year, and when they brought them back, it was with Sherry as their valet. And I remember Sherry, when she did her Hall of Fame acceptance speech for WWE, mentioned that they were just trying to play off of the OJ trial, and I don't really quite know what that means, but that's what they were going for.
Black guys and white woman, I guess. That's
yeah, I guess so.
They're supposed to murder her eventually? Is that the theory?
Yeah, they were going to come to the ring in a Bronco. And
then who's the closest guy with a mullet we can say was going to be driving the Bronco for him? Brad Armstrong, I guess, was driving the...
Actually, Brian Pillman does kind of look like Cato Caitlin.
Right. So I got Booker T in the back!
Oh, Christ.
Scott, your thoughts on Harlem Heat at this point?
Very raw. You could tell that they could have been destined for good things, but yeah, as the guy said, as our colleagues have said, this match is very, very choppy, and it was a good opener to get out of the way. I even think almost 10 minutes is too long. I probably could have cut this to like maybe 6 minutes instead of 9:47, but you knew that they had something. You didn't know where it was, but you knew they had something.
It was the look, man. I mean, you know, they had nice gear, man. You know, Booker T's always been in good shape. Even Stevie Ray looks powerful. It's just such awkward movements, man. Mm-hmm. It was just they could put the in-ring together, you know. Yeah.
He really was awkward. I think it's the best way to describe Stevie Ray is just awkward. He never looked to know how to move around or what to do.
Well, he gets hit with the left and he falls right. You know, it was just
all over the place.
It was, I don't know, man. We're spending way too much time on Harlem Heat, man.
All right, we'll get to the next match. This is the one you've been dying to talk about. You're texting me all day. Jungle Jim Steele versus the Equalizer. Equalizer. This is pre Dave Sullivan reveal, which I think was pretty much shortly right after this.
Poor Evad.
Yes, eventually Evad. Jim Steele. All right, Will, go ahead. Pontificate on Jim Steele.
Man, yeah, I'm going to talk about this match for about 12 seconds.
All right, go ahead.
I like that they renamed the Thez Press the Steel Trap. There you go.
Steel Trap.
That was awful.
That's all I got, man. This is I will say this. Out of the four pay-per-views that we watch, guys, this is the worst match on all four pay-per-views for me. This was the only one that I thought, man, I hope I never watch this again.
And crappy on paper and on in execution.
Yeah.
And
I went into every match with an open mind, man. I didn't judge anybody by their reputation. I didn't, you know, I tried to just go in, enjoy the shows, and this was bad. So.
Yeah,
as bad as it sounds on paper.
Yes, and that's all. I don't have much to say about it either, you guys, before we move on.
No, it's pretty bad.
Okay. Yeah. Charles, I'll start with you with this one. Terry Taylor defeats Diamond Dallas Page, 11:45. DDP had the Diamond Doll, not yet Kimberly, To me, this is the first really good match of these pay-per-view stretches here that we're watching. I really enjoyed this one. Were you surprised Terry Taylor got the win, though? It seemed like they're starting to line up Paige a little bit for a push, and Taylor didn't really seem to have much going on.
Yeah, I was surprised by that because I wasn't aware that Terry Taylor had ever won a match after like 1991. So it really genuinely did surprise me. But yeah, I mean, I thought the match was pretty good. I think DDP in 94 was starting to improve from where he was in the past. And this match is probably the first time that we saw him starting to put things together. I mean, I think he eventually got much better, mm-hmm. even than he was here, but he gave a perfectly respectable performance in this match.
I agree. And Taylor, I mean, he had come off such a milquetoast run in WWF at that point in late 92 or early 93, to the point where he was doing interview segments and interviewing, you know, podunk families out in Dayton, Ohio, King of the Ring and everything else. So really just came back in here without much fanfare. So, yeah, I agree. Kind of a weird choice to go over here. You agree, Will?
No, I agree also. But, you know, I think they made DDP do the job because his ring outfit was horrible. What the
the suspenders.
He's like wearing red cowboy boots, the suspenders plus the like the baggy black pants. I don't know. Ring outfits aren't really my thing. I'm sure it sounds that way right now.
Well, you keep harping on it, so
yeah. Well, but seriously, that's what I came out of this match with is that, and that I really liked this match too. I was really shocked that I was going to enjoy this match. I thought this would be in the ho hum category, but I agree with you, Scott and Justin. This is great. So I enjoyed it.
Yeah, Kimberly had made one appearance in April of '91. When they were dating as the Doll, and then she didn't really come back until I think mid 94. So she became the regular Diamond Doll. So a different one here. Yep. Scott, any thoughts? Were you a Terry Taylor fan?
Kind of. I mean, I liked him actually more in his earlier incarnations in the mid 80s in Mid Atlantic, when he was kind of an up and comer. After the Terrence Taylor run with the York Foundation, I kind of soured on him. And then, of course, the unbelievably awesome interview at the King of the Ring 93 with Wesley and the Misfits.
Yes.
Kind of got me back in the... But, I mean, he was a good worker. He was always a good guy to put on a show. But, I mean, he wasn't anybody I would fawn after. But he, he was okay. He was a good worker. He was serviceable when you needed him.
Did any of you guys see anything in Paige at this time? Or did you just think this is... I mean, could anyone have predicted what he would become?
No way.
Yeah, no way. To me, he was, I kind of put him in the same category as the Z-Man.
Yeah.
At that point in time, just people that had been in WCW forever that no one knew why they were there, I guess.
Well, Z-Man was pretty. Okay.
Yeah, he was a former Mr. Minnesota, as we were so often reminded. But, but yeah, I mean, to me, they were kind of in the same boat.
Yeah, weird that all of a sudden they up and started pushing Paige, and I know he made the push himself by saying he wanted to become a wrestler and everything else, but still an odd decision here, mid-94, when the roster was pretty stacked. Just kind of odd time. Maybe you would have thought a year before when they were hurting a little bit in the mid-card, they would have maybe tried to elevate him. Odd decision now, but, you know, worked out in the end, so...
And he was 36 years old. Isn't that, I mean, it sounds so strange just because of the path his career has followed, but
right.
DDP was 36 years old in 1994.
So is he officially wrestling's Benjamin Button? Because I feel like he's like even younger now than he ever was. He's like in awesome shape doing the yoga stuff. He looks like he's like 18 half the time doing this stuff. And it's like, what the fuck?
18 with mini facelifts. Let's just get that clear.
Yeah, that's very true. Yes, very true. At the time, plastic. He looked like he was like 50. So he's definitely aging in reverse, but... all right, so calling back on an angle from earlier, of course, Michael Hayes was supposed to face Johnny B. Bad. He comes out in a wheelchair with Jimmy Garvin, looking like somebody's uncle, wheeling him out. They did a whole spoof there with, you know, Hayes being banged up. He couldn't wrestle. So they said, okay, well, Garvin, you're going to step in. Of course, Nick Bockwinkel, the commissioner at this time, came out and said that. And they had the match here. Johnny B. Bad defeated Jimmy Garvin, 10-48. Did you like this angle? Was Hayes really hurt, Will? Do you know?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't know. I mean, Charles, was he hurt?
I don't think so. I don't think so. But I feel bad for him because it seemed like he really wanted the match. He just was injured. I mean, I had sympathy for the guy.
I'm the wrong person to ask history questions. I'm a history teacher by trade, and I don't shit about history. So, wrong person to ask about that, but I'm kind of glad we got Jimmy Garvin in the match, man. So, you know, I'm glad Hayes was hurt for this.
Charles, what did you think about Bad at this point? Is this a guy you saw something in? Maybe, you know, with Paige, we said no, but Bad, or was he another guy you put in that boat with Zenk? He had been around now about 3 years, right? He came in, I think, in mid-91, had really been floating around and now starting to finally get a solid push.
When I came online, I was really honestly surprised that people didn't think Johnny B. Bad was solid in the ring. I mean, he was never great, but mm-hmm. When I watched at the time, he didn't stand out to me as someone who didn't know what he was doing. And you could actually say that for a couple of guys, because I remember Johnny B. Bad. I remember people actually saying at one point that Bagwell had potential. So there were a few guys like that that now we look back on and they kind of have these bad reputations, but. I think Johnny B. Bad, I mean, he wasn't changing the world, but he was a perfectly good wrestler.
I always enjoyed him too at the time, and I got online probably in, it was like early 96, and I was pretty pumped when he jumped ship because, you know, he's coming off the, he'll eventually become, U.S. champion, then he lost to Luger, and then jumped over, or was it TV champion, and then he jumped over at WrestleMania 12, and I remember thinking that was like a huge pickup for them. It seemed like he was really on the rise at that point. So I'm with you, Charles. I was always a little bit surprised at the backlash at the time. A guy that always had a lot of energy, a lot of charisma, and it was a fine worker, I thought, in the mid-card at this time.
Can I throw something in here?
Yeah.
Here real quick? Yeah, I think it was the gimmick that did him in, man. I mean, somebody thought he looked like Little Richard, so they dress him up like Little Richard. In the 90s, when Richard was popular in the 50s, and then they wonder why it doesn't get over. You know, or like that, like it should. But I really enjoyed Johnny B. Bad during this time as a wrestler. Take away the makeup and the confetti and the what did he call his little confetti shooters?
The bad blaster.
Take away all that stuff, man. And mechanically, man, he's really good, man. I enjoyed all of the Johnny B. Bad matches on the pay per views we watched so far. So full disclosure,
very
so.
Good seller too.
I actually love the gimmick. I think it was great. I thought he had like awesome facial expressions, especially when he first came out when he was still really green in like 91. I thought the gimmick was great. The problem was that he was in WCW. They didn't know really how to market gimmicks the way that the WWF did. But I think Johnny B. Bad in the WWF during that time would be pretty fondly remembered and probably would have gotten over.
I disagree with you, man. But we'll continue that conversation another.
Well, yeah. I found it interesting, too, that by the time he did get this push, they really had toned down that character. And then, to me, he gets a little bit more serious over the last year and a half of his WCW sure. run. And that's kind of coincides with his push. So
it was kind of like Little Richard going acoustic.
I think there were many Johnny B. Bad jokes at my cousin's house at WrestleMania 10 when Little Richard did the America the Beautiful before that.
Nice.
All right, Scott, why don't you lead us off here, and then I'm going to tee Will up, because I know he's got a lot to talk about. Lord Steven Regal defeats Arn Anderson for the television title, 27-32.
Ugh, I absolutely, unequivocally love this match.
Nice.
First of all, Arn Anderson, as JR knows, is one of my like five favorite guys of all time. So, and Regal, a guy that I always knew a lot about anyway, but watching these four pay-per-views again... one thing I love about him, and you see it in his eyes, there's always method. There's a method. There's a scheme. Now, every wrestler thinks that way. I know that. But with him, it's different. It's one thing to be like, all right, I'm going to do a move which leads to something in a little while. I feel like Regal was already ahead when he was executing something, like particularly with the submissions. And with a guy like Arn, who's, in the immortal words of anybody, tough as a $2 steak, you could just pound Arn to death, and he's fine with it. So Regal was a great guy to hook up with him and other guys in WCW that were a little more green, a little less green, more experienced, that could take a good beating, because he was the kind of guy that, all right, I'm doing this submission, not because it just looks good, but because about 5 minutes from now, I'm going to do something else that's going to connect with this submission, whether it's an arm bar and he's driving a knee into the guy's rib, or he's got his knee in his neck or something like that. You know that 5 minutes from now, he's going to do something that's going to remind you that, oh, shit, I remember he was working on his shoulder 5 minutes ago. That's Regal. And there weren't a lot of guys in WCW at this time that were thinking that way. And that's why I think he was – and that's why I think it was good to put him as the TV champion, a guy that you guarantee was going to be on all the time.
Scott, and, look, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Because, dude, you're just making my heart melt right now. But
Well, but, hang on, because I was just telling Chad that Scott was gushing this match, and I literally said, I think he just melted Will's heart right before you said that. It's in there in writing. I can prove
you
it.
You are, man. I want to send you a Valentine's gift. But, awesome. But seriously, when you watch Regal, I know when I watch Regal, I have to pay attention to every digit, whether it's a finger, the wrist, the forearm, the elbow, because you know he's going to do something where every motion counts, where yep. every movement counts, absolutely. Where whether it's sliding that fucking forearm across the face, whether it's putting an elbow into the neck, or you know, twisting a finger. We saw that with the Cassius Ohno match, or you know, like when they were doing that finger match, where just every single motion counts. You have to pay attention. It's like a PhD work for wrestling enthusiasts.
Absolutely. And I think in this particular instance, you have a guy in Arn who is not, never was, I don't know how to say this. This is not insulting by any stretch, but Arn was never polished per se. He was methodical, but in a different way. He would throw an arm, throw in a clothesline, a lot of knees, a good striker, you know, stuff he learned from Ole, but he was always a good seller. And you never saw that much during the Horseman years because a lot of them don't sold a lot. But in this instance, Regal, I think, was a perfect guy for Arn to kind of get his juices back. You know, 94, he was getting up there in years. And I think this match really is is one of the benchmark matches that people remember from the show. And Will, I think you and I aren't the only two that gush about it. Because, again, Regal had a template with which to work with. And, you know, a lot of guys, as we'll see down the line, Regal didn't have a lot of guys that can react to his kind of moves. And I think Arn was the perfect guy for that. And 27 minutes is not too long. That's one thing I liked about WCW. WWE seems to hold off long matches for main events, even if it's two guys who have no business working 27 minutes. WCW took two guys who could, regardless of where they are on the card, whether there's a belt in the line, and gave them those minutes because they knew it worked.
Yeah.
That hurts. Now, let me just finish this point, Will. It hurts after the fact when Bischoff starts getting in and then the NWO, and then you got a bunch of guys who could barely work 5 minutes. But in this instance, WCW was not afraid. And I wonder if that was part of, you know, one of the few things that Watts did well was he knew how to get the most out of the guys when he could get the most out of them. Some guys could work 25, some guys work 11, some guys work 2. It all depends on who it is. But it didn't matter where they were in the card or how important the belt was. WWE needs to stop being snobby about that and give the right guys the right amount of minutes. And I think
I think it's the difference, Justin, in a wrestling philosophy where you have a template and you fit everyone into that template versus a wrestling philosophy where you have wrestlers and you just maximize everyone. And to me, WWE is very much just throwing everyone in their template instead of the other way around. Where WCW, I think maybe they benefited in some ways from the kind of organized chaos that happened in that company so often, because you didn't really have a micromanager like a Vince McMahon or even a Paul Heyman looking over everything. So they would just, you know, throw something out there to kill time, and then the wrestlers would just kind of own it and make something out of it. And I think that's what happened here.
Okay. Well, what I was going to add is, Scott, you mentioned that this has a good reputation. Actually, at the time, Dave Meltzer, I think, gave it a star or two star, said it was way too much time. They shouldn't have gotten that much time. And that's why I was kind of bummed Scott Keith didn't show up, because I really wanted him to re-examine this match, because I think he reviewed it 10 years ago or something. And he knocked on it, said, way too boring, way too long. And I watched it. I'm thinking, man, this is like one of my match of the years. You know, what am I missing that Meltzer and Keith aren't getting? You know, and to hear you say that, I'm like, okay. And I think what it is that when you watch Regal and Arn go at it, They're wrestlers for adults, and I'm not, what I mean is we're all, you know, past our 30s. We've all seen 40s. A ton of wrestling. Yeah, 40s. Yeah, okay, whatever.
I didn't pass it yet, for Christ's sake. After I shovel tonight, I might feel after.
But you know what I mean? Like, I would not have appreciated this match if I was 18.
Right.
You know, but you know, 20 years later, it's one of my favorite matches that I've seen. And, you know, I think it's Regal is what I call an adult's wrestler. He's just not a real man's man. He is a wrestler for adults, for people who, you know, I don't want to say take their wrestling seriously, but that like to pay attention to the details of the performance of wrestling, if that makes sense.
So, Will, as a belated Christmas gift to you, I'm going to make sure Scott Keith listens to this. I'm going to ask him if he'll watch the match and do a write-up on PlayStation.com. I'm going to push for that for you.
Well, you know, it's not that. It's you know, if he doesn't like it, he doesn't like it.
Well, we need to have him examine it, because I'm guessing at the time he wrote it, he was much younger.
Of course. That's what I say, is because, like, you know, I mean, like, Charles and I disagree on wrestlers and matches all the time. Rob Naylor, my co-host for many years, man, we don't agree on much in wrestling, but when we do agree, we celebrate it, and you know, we do podcasts about it. But you know, I don't care if someone agrees with me or disagrees, but I want to know, you know, I can tell you exactly what I loved about this match. I want to know exactly what these guys did not like. It can't just be the time, because that's a cop-out. It has to be what in the match was actually bad. What did not work? When I listened to the crowd was into it when they should have been into it. I thought Scott did a great job of explaining why the match was great in and of itself. And so that's what I'm curious. What about the match did not work? Was it the stiffest fuck headbutts or those nasty forearms? Was it Regal not going after the leg early, but then when he got in trouble later in the match, he goes after the leg because he knew he had the leg the whole time? There's no reason to go after it early like Pillman does later. He's going to go after it when he's in trouble, man. I just love that shit. That's beautiful.
Yeah, and Will, if I can just add something there, that's actually my favorite thing about the match, that he doesn't go for the leg right away. Arn Anderson is not a wrestler that works over the leg. He's a wrestler that works over the arm. So he spent, you know, the majority of the match working over the arm, and it made sense. The bullseye was on it because Regal had it taped up. He realized, like, 20 minutes into the match that Regal still had too much in reserve. So he changed his strategy, went after the leg. The crowd came unglued at that point, because it's almost like people were watching and they saw that bullseye the whole time. And they're like, when is Arn going to do this? I thought that was really smart, because, I mean, it was great within the match, but it also was true to who Arn Anderson is.
Yes. Yes.
I agree.
He said it. Beautiful.
And you know what else, too, I like about this whole stretch with Regal? A lot of times with the TV title, I don't want to call it a cop-out, but, you know, they'd use the draw a lot as a way to get out of the match. And a lot of times it made sense. The champion is trying to get to the draw. I liked here, though, three out of these four pay-per-views, we see the TV title on the line, we get a finish. And every time it kind of surprised me. So maybe the whole draw thing worked, because a lot of times I was expecting them to hit the time limit. And I was happy here we get the finish, and then over the next few shows we see finishes as well, which I thought really helped build Regal throughout the year. As a strong player, he didn't just always escape via the draw. He could go 28 minutes with Arn Anderson, a guy that earned a lot of respect in the fans' eyes, and defeat him in the middle of the ring.
Hey, before we leave this match, let me ask each of you, after it hit 25, 26 minutes, who here thought this was going to end in a draw?
Oh, no doubt.
No doubt,
I didn't. I thought Arn was going to win.
Okay, so you actually thought that, you know, Arn was going to win the match, but that...
Yeah, I did.
Okay. Yeah, see, I thought this was a draw. I thought this is a 30-minute draw. They pushed it 30 minutes, and, you know, whereas Regal's going to survive 15 minutes with most, he has to survive 30 with that grizzled vet Arn Anderson. So, you know, I was not expecting a pinfall in this. And then to get it, to me, that just adds to the match.
Agreed. So. And that's why I love, too, that they almost went 30. So they really teased you to that point where, okay, like you said, we're going to a draw. And then all of a sudden it comes out of nowhere and he pins him. And it's like, whoa, that was awesome. That was a great finish.
And the Memphis fan in me loves Bill Dundee just hitting those nasty umbrella shots, man. Yeah. Just boom, hit him like it's Memphis, baby. That's what I like.
Well,
like,
I want to talk.
Here comes the rain again.
And I do want to talk about him as Sir William, but let's save that for the next Regal match. We'll get back to Regal. Sure. He's on this every show here. So, all right, next up, we have the first installment pay-per-view-wise. Cactus Jack and Max Payne defeated the Nasty Boys, the World Tag Team Champions, by disqualification, 12 and a half minutes. These two teams had fought on The Clash before this as well. Fight here in a straight-up match, and of course that will lead to something even greater a month later. So I think we should really save maybe this feud for Spring Stampede. But any quick thoughts on this match itself, Charles?
Not really. I think it was, I mean, I liked the match, but I do think it's more of a teaser for what's to come.
Yeah. And I think there's a reason it was set between the Regal Arn match and then the two main events. I think it's exactly because of that. They knew it was just going to be an appetizer for the next month or for the next show. So they didn't want to, I feel like they didn't build it as a huge match, and it was just almost there to just kind of stick in the back of your mind. Do you agree, Will?
Yeah, I'm just going to say that this is better than Harlem Heat versus Thunder and Lightning, and but not by much, really. And you know, it's really there for the big bump that Cactus takes, that holy shit flat back bump on the concrete. I think that's what this match is about, that big bump.
Scott, what did you think of this match, and what do you think of Max Payne?
I liked Max Payne's promo skills. His ability in the ring is, you know, it's there. But he cut a great. He kind of dictated the promo cutting between him and Cactus before this match, and I kind of dug it. I think he got. He understood how to get the match over, and he might be forgotten in some of the wrestling pantheons, other than the match that we're going to talk about in a little bit. And but I did like the promo he cut leading into this match. It was very intense. He kind of let, you know, Cactus kind of sat back and let him do all the talking. I work rate wise, he's pretty much a. Kind of a poor man's Mick Foley, really. But
well, I mean, yeah, but I didn't think he actually wasn't a bad mat guy. Like, I mean, no. Not great, but I felt like he would go to the mat and it's kind of surprise you here and there. And I think him and Cactus tried to do that early on in this match. So, all right.
So, yeah.
Let's get to our double main event, both inside the Thunder Cage. And Charles, why don't you quickly tell us what a Thunder Cage is?
It's a huge cage, ridiculous in size, that kind of... Yeah, I have no idea. I'm sorry.
It's a giant, I put you right on the spot on that one. It is a Thunder Cage. It's just a giant cage. It's almost like a Hell in a Cell without a roof, basically, right? I mean,
it's a Hell in a Cell without a roof if it was built in 1970s Alabama, you know, for like Fuller's Continental or something, man. God, that was such a horrible cage. I mean, it's a huge cage. Like you said, it's about the size of Hell in a Cell. But man, that thing, I just felt like, that thing was just going to tip over. Yeah.
You know, wouldn't it be so... I know that Hell in a Cell didn't exist at this point. It came like 3 years later. But wouldn't it be so WCW to create a match like that and call it Suspense and Offense?
Man, you're just coming up with the one-liners tonight, man. You must have a book like Jerry Lawler. Oh, Suspense and Offense. There it is. All right. It's awesome. It's awesome.
All right, well, inside the fence here, we have Sting, Brian Pillman, and Dustin Rhodes taking on Steve Austin, Rick Rude, and Paul Orndorff with Colonel Robert Parker. They go 15 minutes. Pillman pins Austin with a splash to kind of put a nail in the coffin of the Hollywood Blonde split-up angle. All right, a lot going on with these six guys here. So, Will, why don't you take the face team? I'm setting you up here. Take the face team. Talk about those three guys quickly, and then we'll get to the match itself.
What do you want to know about the face team?
Dustin. I want to know which of these three guys you like the most and why.
Oh well, hell, man, it has to be Dustin Rhodes.
Oh, all right.
If I had to pick one of my top three favorites of all of these guys we're going to talk about tonight, Dustin Rhodes is one of my MVPs of these four pay-per-views. Just like he's doing right now with Goldust. He's doing great, you know, selling segments, face and peril segments. He's doing great offensive shine segments, you know, when he gets the hot tag. He does it here. He does it later on. I bet he wish he had a good hot tag in that final match we see. Little foreshadowing. But Dustin Rhodes, you see him here. And then you see his path as Goldust, where, you know, he had a great career. People remember Goldust. You just kind of wish that he was elevated to a higher level than he actually made. You know, he's always hovered around that U.S. title, Intercontinental title, tag title level. Never went to super main event legend guy, you know. And I really wish he would have made it that way. I thought Brian Pillman was great in this match. One of the things I really like is Orndorff kicking Pillman in the throat. I know they had already explained his raspy voice, but those kicks from Orndorff would have been a good explanation. And then Sting was fucking over, man. He you know, He got those tags, man. That crowd came alive, but by far the least of the three guys on that face team.
Charles, what did you think of the heel squad here?
I thought Steve Austin was the only guy. Like, well, first of all, I'll just say that I'm not as high on this match as Will is, but also, to me, Steve Austin was the only guy that seemed to be trying to work the cage into the match at all. To me, he gave the best performance on the heel side in terms of taking, you know, nice bumps and actually trying to work this like a cage match. But I don't know. The whole thing just kind of felt flat to me.
I liked it as far as the sprint pace of it. I felt it was short. Like, I'm glad we got the 28 minutes from Regal, but I feel like he could have maybe trimmed a few minutes here or there, or even just dumped the Equalizer match or even the Harlem Heat match. I mean, with these six guys in a cage, you only go 14 and a half minutes. To me, it definitely felt rushed. Scott, do you agree?
Yeah, and I also agree with Charles' point about Austin being the only guy that took advantage of the cage. And I feel like he was the only one that was actually trying to really put the match and his team over. I was not a big Orndorff fan at this point. And Rude does things Rude's way. And Austin was the one who was flying his body all over the place, and he hit the cage wall. And at the pace the match was going, I was perfectly happy with 14 and a half minutes. I don't think it should have gone any longer. I don't think it was going at a good enough pace to go longer than 14 and a half minutes, because I think Austin was really carrying the heels. I agree with Will about Dustin Rhodes. I think the kid was amazing. And I think Sting, it's weird. I see Sting and I think of Cena. I don't know why. It's almost like that early 90s, what Cena would become, even more than Hogan. Sting was a guy who the fans just absolutely loved, whose work rate was good, not awesome, but he didn't suck. I know a lot of people, there are a lot of people on the internet and that I've ever known who think that Sting was an atrocious worker. I disagree with that. And I think that this match, sadly, because the heels weren't working hard enough to put the faces over and put the match over, I'm glad it wasn't longer than 14 and a half minutes. But I agree with Charles that Austin was dominating this match for the heels. I mean, he was throwing his body all over the place and smacked his face into the cage, and he sacrificed a lot to make this match look better than it might have been.
Hey, do you mind if I jump in here real quick?
No, go ahead.
I guess when I went into this match, I never expect WCW to do anything right anyway, you know? So for me watching this match, I didn't think, okay, how are they going to use this cage? And I noticed Austin doing those crazy bumps, like leaping from the apron and then doing a hook or whatever, leaping onto the cage and, you know, in the crotch position or whatever. Man, crotch posting, that's what I was looking for. But man, I thought
crotch.
You mentioned crotches and I get all nervous. But anyway, but I actually like the sprint nature of this match, man. It's kind of one of those matches where there just wasn't a dull moment. Yeah, they could have used the cage more, but just if you look at it just like as a six man, I thought it was an above average six man, you know. But you know, I mean, as we'll see with our next match, you know. Like I said, it's WCW. They had no idea why they were even advertising a Thunderdome, except that it probably sounded cool to somebody. So they built, like I said, this fucking cage. So,
you know, I know that Will is kind of the ring attire guy on this show, but this really did seem like a match that would have benefited from everyone wearing street clothes.
Yeah.
And also,
hold on, Charles. Orndorff and Austin did look like tag partners in black and gold. I did notice that.
Yeah, but I wanted to see like the jeans with knee pads and somebody pulling out powder and like chains. Like that's what I was kind of hoping for with this match when I saw it on paper, and that's not what we got.
Yeah.
All right, why don't we move forward to this one, and we'll wrap up Super Bowl at the main event here.
Wait, Justin, what was your thoughts, man? Come on.
Oh, my thoughts. I liked it. I'd probably lean more towards Will than with Scott and Charles in this one. I liked the, and Will, I think we were texting while we were both watching it like at the same time. I liked the sprint feel of it, and I agree with you guys. I thought Austin really dominated the match on the heel side, and to me, he came off as the star of the match. And I think that was his design. He was a smart guy. He knew when he had these opportunities that he had to make the most of it, a guy that always had a high motor at that time, and he showed it off. I think he knew, hey, this is my chance with a lot of big-name guys in a big spot to really prove my worth. And I think he was pissed coming off the Hollywood Blonde stuff. I think he was still mad that they broke them up coming off such a great tag team run. I think he felt like there was a lot left in the tank. Yeah. And I think both him and Pillman were motivated to prove everyone wrong, and I think that comes across big time in this match.
I agree with you, man. I liked it.
All right, now let's get to the main event. Ric Flair, Vader in a rematch from Starrcade, again inside the Thunder Cage. This one goes 11 and a half minutes. Ric Flair wins the match when Vader submits to the figure four. Of course, we have some interference from the boss, the special guest referee, the big boss man, Ray Traylor, had come in, I think, just a little bit before the show he had debuted, right? Or was it late 93? Was he in around late 93?
I'm not sure. Yeah, he was around in late 93.
Right, okay. So a big spot for him, honestly. They used him as almost like a main event level guy being involved in this feud and with Vader. And we'll get to the boss in the ring over the next couple of shows. I didn't really enjoy him in this match, though. I thought he overwhelmed. I wanted more of a blow-off between Flair and Vader with the way this feud had built coming off of Starrcade. I thought he was too much involved. I know they were just trying to set up the feud with him and Vader, but I just didn't like his involvement here. I thought it was just overwhelming. And Charles, you agree, disagree?
Yeah. And I actually thought the match was going along really well until all that crap started. But it really took away from the ending of the feud. It took away from, I mean, this was one of the most well-booked feuds up until the ending that WCW ever did. I mean, the hype for both Starrcade and for this match was excellent. And so it was a shame to see it in the way it did.
And just to note, he did debut on the December 18th, 93 Saturday night. He actually pinned Rude in a non-title match and then lost to Rude at Starrcade and then moved into this feud here, the boss. And he, of course, he had a very similar outfit as to when he was the big boss man, only he was black. So still pretty much using that gimmick. Will, what did you think of this one? Did you agree, disagree that boss man overshadowed it?
I don't think he overshadowed it because I thought there was a lot of cool shit in this match. Like, well, first we got to mention Vader's fleece. I thought that was his cape. If guys wore capes like that today, they'd be much more over.
I'm
looking like Vikings. But no, I mean, there's some cool stuff like Vader doing a Flair flip. Okay, who knew he could do a Flair flip, right, out of the corner? And then he does the moonsault. This is my favorite part of the match, where he does the moonsault. Flair rolls out of the way, and Vader lands on his feet. You know, I think he then goes to his knees to catch himself from falling back. But then he goes and does the Vader clobber in the corner. And it was really set up really nice. So to me, it was one of my favorite moments in the match. And I thought the match was going along great. I was really loving it. Again, not using the cage like they could have, but really going along nice up until that stupid ending. I think the ending ruined it. However, I liked the match up until all of that crap.
All right, so as we wrap, I'm sorry, Scott, do you have any thoughts on this one?
No, I'm actually glad the match was shorter than the one at Starrcade by about 10 minutes. I don't think they needed to go like 20 minutes again. Mm. I thought the story was fine for 11 and a half minutes. So I thought the boss was adequate. I wouldn't say he went too crazy, but I'm just glad Flair won and we can move on to something else.
All right, so quick thoughts on Super Brawl as a whole. Will, just really quick, what did you think of the show?
I'm sorry, guys. What was the question?
Just a really quick 5 seconds on what you thought of Super Brawl as a whole.
I thought it was a good pay-per-view, bordering on great. Absolutely one great match with Regal and Arn. Several very good matches and a couple of stinkers. But overall, I mean, this is a thumbs-up pay-per-view for me.
Charles?
Yeah, I think the next two pay-per-views or the next three that we're going to talk about are better, but this was a good outing. No, aside from Arn Regal, I don't think there were any like blowaway matches, but everything was pretty solid.
Scott?
I agree with Charles. I think this was a good prelude to what we were going to get the next three shows.
I gotta be honest with you, after watching it, Regal Arn might be one of my like 10 favorite WCW matches of all time. But nice. And the rest of the matches are good, but not great. But it's a good prelude to what's to come.
All right, and now we get to what may be the best show of this run. We'll see. And that is the final Spring Stampede for 3 years here in 1994 from the Rosemont Horizon, Chicago, Illinois. And the big match everyone had waited for, Danny Bonaduce and Christopher Knight, and the dark match in Chicago.
Fuck yeah.
Aaron Neville, the Star Spangled Banner, of course. And we head inside the show. So now that we're here, we'll talk about the matches. We don't have to really get into the performers unless it's something we didn't get to, a Super Brawl. So we'll kick us off. Johnny B. Badd defeats the Diamond Dallas Page, almost like a preview of their feud to come a year later. No titles on the line here or anything, just a quick 6 minutes. And Bad wins with a sunset flip. Did you like this here? Did you feel like Paige was continuing the climb up the ladder in 94?
Man, I thought this was another eye-opener for me because like, I liked Bad at the Super Brawl match, and I liked DDP in the Super Brawl match. And then they have like a really exciting TV match. To me, this is more like a TV match. You know, like you said, nice 6 minutes. I was never bored during it. I was entertained the whole time. It was kind of a sprint, but you know, solid match, man. No complaints whatsoever about this match.
Charles?
I think on this show, this was the perfect match to open the show because they didn't need to go out there. They didn't need to put a match out first, considering how loaded this card was, where they were going to go out there and try to break their necks to steal the show. So I think this was the perfect opener because it popped the crowd. They got in, did their thing, and got out. So I was entertained by it.
And Scott?
Good match. I was enjoying seeing the evolution of DDP in the ring.
And both of them, I think.
You know, yeah. I think, well, we knew Johnny B. Badd's abilities going in. DDP was, I think, in that same awkward, clumsy, not clumsy, but very awkward thing as not maybe not as bad as Stevie Ray.
Oh, no.
But I feel like DDP was, yeah, no, not that bad. But I do feel DDP was kind of feeling his way around in the ring still a little bit. But yeah, this was a good solid 6 minutes to start the show.
Well, I think you can say this about Stevie Ray too. I mean, we'll see, you got me in my head. He sucks. Now, about DDP too, is he was someone that could absorb and learn. So when he's with guys that are good or better, you know, a lot better than him, he always seems to take notes to learn and to improve based on it. And that's what I always liked about him. He wasn't someone that worked with a ton of good guys and still blew. You could tell he was taking the best aspects of those matches and using them in future ones. I thought that was a good sign of a guy that was really dedicated to his craft. So I thought it was a good sign here for DDP as we kind of move through his growth in 94. All right, up next, Charles, kick us off here. Steven Regal, and this is the one time we do get a draw on this pay-per-view stretch with the TV title on the line, fights Brian Pillman to the 15-minute limit, and of course, Regal retains.
Regal was awesome. Obviously, I think we've established that. I mean, there are some tricked out mat things that he does in this match, like that rolling thing that he did from the corner that I don't even know how to describe, that I thought looked great. I mean, this was a really fun match. And what I really liked about it also is that Pillman changed his style up from what he normally did too, just to kind of match what Regal was doing. So he was more grounded and was more of an aggressor and was throwing stiff strikes and hard chops. And I thought they had really good chemistry. I thought this was a very good match.
Scott, what do you think?
What more can you say about Regal? And I tell you, Pillman kind of went with the formula. Obviously not as experienced as Arn was, you know, as Arn is in the same slot 2 months earlier, which is why I think the match was shorter. But still, I think Pillman really enveloped Regal's methods in this match and really, you know, really took to it. And I thought it was a great match. I thought it was another good example of Regal. And I'll tell you something very quickly. Guys who wrestle, you know, obviously wrestling is a physical activity and guys sweat, but you don't really see it too much in matches. Like Cena has like no sweat glands. But let me tell you something. All four of these shows I watched after Regal match, man, they are drenched.
Yeah,
you could tell that they are really working their asses off in Regal and his opponent are working their asses off in the ring when they're going. It's just amazing.
And we never appreciated that shit as kids, man. Just like, you know,
yeah,
and,
you're right.
And now I just like I eat it up, man, like soup. Anyway,
yeah.
But sorry, Scott. Continue.
No, that's okay. No, I'm done. No, that's my point.
What do you got?
Oh, man, there's so much stuff to love about this match. You know, like we talked about Arn waiting to go after the leg in the last match when it's 30 minutes. Well, Pillman's only got 15. What's the first thing he does, man? Attack that leg. And so I kind of like that in the last match, Arn holds off. Pillman's like, shit, I don't have that much time. I better go for it now. You know, and then he does stuff like when Regal's begging off in the corner, Pillman getting on his knees and slapping Regal. You know, or we talked about the little things that Regal does. Like he had to kick Pillman's arm away with his foot so he could apply the Regal stretch with his arms. And it's just like, man, just like I said, pay attention to those joints of Regal. You know, every single movement counts, you know. And then maybe y'all didn't notice this, but in between those six strikes, like, you know, Pillman chopping the shit out of Regal or Regal kicking Pillman in the head, did you notice that as the match went on, if you look at Pillman's face, you can see the visible frustration on his face as he keeps trying to work these hope spots in between those Regal control segments?
Yeah.
Only for Regal to cut him off, and Pillman's like, shit, what do I have to do to beat this guy?
Yep.
Did y'all notice that? I mean, is that in my head?
Nope. No, it wasn't.
No. That's why I think they worked their butts off even more. I think that's why Pillman was spent after those 15 minutes. I think for that reason. I think trying to figure out that calculator of a brain that Regal's doing in a match is just it's poetry.
And I think
really
Pillman
is.
Was a good choice of the draw match. A guy that could work that quick 15-minute pace and always worked when he needed to, he could work with a lot of I won't say anxiety, but what's the word I'm looking for? A lot of importance. I'm trying to think of the word, but basically just knowing the time is running down, he's going to work at a quick pace. I thought he was a good choice for that.
I agree.
I concur. Yes.
And Regal also, we'll continue him moving through here. I liked the leg injury, the wounded champion, and we see him every time. It reminded me a lot of Shawn Michaels in 1993. Scott, we've talked about this. Every pay-per-view, you thought this is going to be the one where he finally loses. And I think we get that with Regal here in 94. It's like every show, all right, he's fighting Pillman, his leg's banged up. This is the time we're going to get a title change. And Regal hangs on. So now we'll move on to another show when we get the Slamboree where he's still TV champion. All right, titles back on the line here. The tag team titles. Nasty Boys versus Cactus Jack and Max Payne in a rematch from Super Brawl, this time in a Chicago street fight. And this may be probably WCW's best kind of trash, hardcore, garbage match. Will, agree, disagree? Where does this match rank WCW history in a garbage match history?
Well, I have mixed feelings on this match, man. Because to me, I liked it better than the last match or the final Cactus Sullivan match we watch on Bash at the Beach. But I don't think it's that great, man. And I think the problem I had with this match is I've seen so much ECW. I've seen so much crazy Memphis brawls, like, you know, where Jerry Lawler's like falling down a flight of bleachers, you know, that this kind of reminds me of Attitude Era brawling, where like you grab a guy's head and you walk to the place where you're going to do your spots. You do your spots, then you walk to the other part of the stadium. You do your spots, then you walk, you know. It's not my favorite type of brawling, man. And I'll probably be the odd man out on this because this is kind of one of those matches I knew the reputation, so I was really excited to see it. And after I watched it, I was like,
Let me ask you this, though. Is that looking through, and I mean, it's perfectly fine, looking through the modern lens, like you said, it's like an attitude brawl, not your favorite.
At the time, man.
It was so unique.
I agree, you know, and I probably, you know, and like I said, that's absolutely looking through 2014. Wow, 2014 eyes. You know, that's looking at it 20 years later, man. I mean, this is something, you know, after, like I said, being exposed to so many bloody, nasty Memphis brawls where, you know, they do go through the crowds and they go into the concession stands and throw bottles of mustard at each other. And, you know, this kind of felt like I said, like too Attitude Era-ish for me, man. And, you know, I actually thought that the next month's pay-per-view did a better job of getting that wild, unpredictable, throw everything at the opponent vibe that they were going for across than this one. And I know I'm an odd man out on this, so that's okay.
Charles, you almost look at this one like Razor Shawn, another match in 1994, WrestleMania 10. The ladder match at the time was just mind-blowing and unique. And looking back now through that lens of kind of the wear and tear of that gimmick, maybe has taken the luster off a little bit, or do you see them as being kind of different in that respect?
I think they're a little bit different. I think this match actually holds up pretty well, but I, at the same time, I actually made a note of the exact same things that we're talking about. So it's interesting that that came up, because there are spots that became comedy spots, you know, like the stuff with the garbage cans and that sort of thing in the early 2000s when you had the 24/7 hardcore division in WWE. So I think you kind of have to set that aside and think about the context in which this happens. And then to me, it's more impressive when you do that. I mean, yeah, maybe there are some things that were kind of inventive at the time. And then later, the spots were kind of killed or overused or whatever. But I don't want to penalize the match too much for that, because I think that, you know, it was wrestled for the audience that saw it at that point in time. And for that audience, it was a great match. What I would also say is that, you know, my favorite moment in this is Cactus is covering one of the Nasty Boys and hello, surprise shovel.
Yeah, that was just, that was definitely the spot of the match.
Just, where did that come from? So, I mean, that was the coolest spot in this match for me. But yeah, I mean, I think this was 10 minutes of mayhem. It felt more violent and unpredictable than a lot of stuff that we've seen that's copied a lot of these spots since that time. So I think that's why I liked it more, is that it felt a little bit fresher, I guess, instead of just like a comedy match.
Were you surprised the Nasties retained?
No, I guess just because I knew the result.
Spoilers.
It was definitely one where I thought, we're going to get the Cactus Pain blow off, but as we'll see, they go another month here. Scott, any quick thoughts on this one?
I never realized how short it was until I just looked at it now. I didn't realize it was only 8:54. It seems longer.
I mean, it seems longer. I think it's the chaos. And the way they present it with the split screen and Tony and Bobby are yelling and the crowd's going crazy. I mean, I think that makes it just fly by.
It's all that walking they're doing, man. It's all that walking.
They had to burn some calories, man. What do you want?
it's an exceptional match. The shovel shots are sick. they really are. And the chair shots are pretty sick, too. So,
all right. Up next, we have another title match, United States Championship on the line. Steve Austin defending for the first time in this pay-per-view stretch against the Great Muta. A match that looked great on paper. I think ended up being a little bit of a styles clash. Will, I'm curious on your thoughts on this one. Muta DQ throws off Austin over the top rope. You know, they play up the whole, you know, that's not a DQ everywhere kind of thing, and he didn't know. Austin retains. This is one that, on a card of great matches, sticks out a little bit as just not clicking.
You know what, man? I'm going to be odd man out here again, man, because I knew the reputation of the match going in. Okay, so I want to disclose that. Like I said, I saw the match that happened before it, and it was such a wild match. Right. I mean, we all agree that even though I'm not, you know, I can't erase 20 years of kind of seeing people copy that. It was such a wild match. There's no way you're going to follow that by doing the same thing. Right. And so I kind of liked the way they worked the match, man. I thought that they were really smart, and I thought Muta was smart and, like, you know, grounding Austin with the headlocks and then kind of pulling out the big Muta spots later on. I think the abdominal stretch spot kind of went on a little bit too long, but I'm a sucker for ab stretch spots anyway. But it, you know, it led to a big Muta comeback, and you know, the finish I thought was hot up until that the horrible over the top rule, man. I was kind of bummed out by that too.
You surprised they didn't just put Austin over, knowing that Muta wasn't?
Yeah, man. I mean, yeah, man. Why not just put, like you said, yeah? Why not just put Austin over? I mean, it wouldn't have hurt him. But I kind of like, you know, watching guys work on the mat and, you know, work in and out of headlock spots. You know, I mean, for 1994, I can absolutely understand why people don't enjoy that. But if you've watched enough 70s and 80s wrestling as I have, man, you kind of expect that's how matches are worked. And so they kind of went for an old school vibe on this, you know. And so I enjoyed the match except for the shitty finish. So, you know, I'm probably the odd man out on this one, too.
Is he, Scott?
Absolutely not. Ending aside, I really like this match a lot.
Wow.
I'll tell you why.
Maybe Charles and I should just go hang out and you guys from the show.
Yeah, yeah.
So Scott, when's the Will and Scott podcast starting? Oh, yeah.
When's Eric Bischoff presiding over the wedding on SmackDown with you guys? Let's talk about WCW.
Here's my thing about this match. I think a lot of people, like you said, Will, I think a lot of people had a thought about this match going in. I think there was a preconceived notion that Muda was going to go, you know, flying around, and Austin's going to be very slow. And I think Muda almost went in thinking, you know what, this guy's not going to, as good a wrestler as Steve Austin is at the time. I think Muda almost was like, you know what, I can find a way to make him look good without lapping him. So I almost feel like, and remember, Muda's a little older. This isn't Muda 89. He's 5 years older than he was when he feuded with Sting. I think he almost tried to pace it so Austin can kind of stay with him. And whether that's a sacrifice or not for Muda, I think that's where he kind of helped out here.
Scott, let me ask Charles a question. Charles, is this before or after Austin broke Chono's neck?
This was after.
See, so Muda's thinking, fuck you, man. I'm not letting you near my neck. I'm going to slow this down.
That's entirely possible, too. I concur with that. So having said that, I think – and in for me – it almost makes the match better than when I was thinking, you know what, I love Austin at the time, but he goes in with a guy like Muda and wrestles at that Muda pace. This thing's going to be a shit show. And it didn't happen. I think almost because of the fact that, wow, this guy fucked up one of my compadres. I got to be careful here. Well, it almost made the match better for me anyway.
Nice, yeah.
I think this match was smart on a micro level in terms of working holds and, you know, everything that Will mentioned. But I don't think it was smart on a macro level in the sense that the Great Muda has a reputation and people expect certain things from him. And when you don't give people a Great Muda match, no matter how good the match is, they're going to be disappointed. And so I think that's where they failed. Not so much that the match wasn't well worked or that they didn't do it right, but that – I mean, the Great Muda was an established wrestler with this audience. They still remembered. I mean, if you recall, like even as late as 2000, the Great Muda showed up in WCW and people still popped for him because they remembered the 89 run. So it was a very memorable first run. And so I think that's the problem that I had with it. Not so much that the match was bad, because it wasn't. It was more that it wasn't a Great Muda match.
Yes,
which is
I was thinking the exact same thing.
I think that works.
Yeah, I feel like his 89 run really maybe clouded expectations of this one. Charles, I think you nailed it.
Yeah, but fuck expectations. It's 2014, baby.
I agree.
all right. But let's break up this love fest. Sting versus Rick Rude for the International World Heavyweight Championship. Sting defeats him to win the title at 12:50. Harley Race accidentally hits Rude, and this looked to be starting a little bit of a Rick Rude face turn. Charles, what did you think of this match? Did you like the title switch, and did you think Rude going face was a good idea?
I think Rick Rude is a natural heel, and Rick Rude is a guy who should never be a babyface. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of glad that didn't, you know, get played out. Not for the reasons that it did. I wish it could have not been played out while Rick Rude could have kept his health. But to me, like, Rick Rude had kind of fallen off of a cliff a little bit by this point anyway. I think he had been working – I suspected that he had been working really hurt for a long time and was trying to hide it. But that said, this was the best match he had in quite a while from my point of view. My main problem with this match, especially when it comes to the finish and all the run-ins and everything, is it was so obvious that everyone from Sting to Rick Rude to the referee to Vader to Harley Race seemed to be waiting on their cue before they did the next thing. So so that was, I guess, what came across to me more than anything. But the finish got a pop. It was, I guess, kind of a nice cap off to the rivalry because I think – if I'm not mistaken, it may have been the first time that Sting actually got a pinfall win over Rick Rude on a pay-per-view or on anything televised for that matter. So I think it worked there, but all those run-ins, just it wasn't executed very well.
Will, what'd you think of this one?
I was enjoying it early on, but at some point, you know, when Rude was applying the world's worst camel clutch,
yes.
Or his patented chin lock, I was thinking, man, I enjoyed Austin Muta more than this, you know, at the time. And then, you know, the crowd was into it, man. Like I said, Sting was over, man. Charles nailed that ending on the head, man. You know, we criticize, like, indie wrestlers, like, not calling it in the ring or, like, you know, over-relying on, like, memorizing where to go from A to B to C to D. And that's exactly how that finish looked, man. I mean, the ref was staring right at him, waiting for his cue. Like, the ref didn't even try to, like, cover his eyes and, like, peek through, like, two fingers, man. He was just watching it all unfold in the corner. And so, man, this is kind of like another match where I would not give it a thumbs up overall on the show. You know, the two matches I from this show I did not have a thumbs up for, and this was one of them. So
do you think labored is a good way to describe that finish? Because it seems like they had gone through it a few times, but it felt
rehearsed. Rehearsed it, kind of like a eighth grade drama production where everybody's nervous that they're going to forget their cue and nobody does, but it looks rehearsed. Yeah, man, not natural at all.
Hey,
man.
Listen, I killed it as Mr. Cherubel and Nicholas Nickleby in eighth grade. I don't know what you're talking about. I was the hero at the end.
I've never heard of that, man. What is that?
you don't want to know. I
heard
the tape.
Of nothing.
What's it called?
Nicholas Nickleby. It was Dickens, wasn't it? I believe Dickens' book.
I think it is Dickens. Yeah.
I have a tape of the play. If you want to put it in your 1994 yearbook, Will, we can.
I already made the 94 yearbook, but well, I'll watch it just to laugh at you.
We can do an addendum. We'll put that at the end of it.
only if we can do my junior year of me singing Grease Lightning as Kanicki and my.
You
know, we always joke that we're going to finally start the YouTube channel, PlaceToBeNation.com, and that may be the first video on it, I think. We're having an internal contest of what's going to be the first video shown.
It's going to be Nickleby or whatever the hell you said, man.
If we're talking talent shows, I just got to share this one thing real quick because it caused like an uproar at my school. But I was in a private school at the time. It's actually a Montessori school, and I was in first grade, and I lip synced David Lee Roth's cover of California Girls, and I had 3 6th grade girls dancing in bikinis behind me, and there were all all these angry parents wrote letters about how scandalous it was. So yeah, I was this controversial first grader that was causing problems at the Montessori.
The Vince Russo of first grade already.
Yeah.
With those slutty 6th graders, man.
Yes.
Damn
you.
Now, see, for Scott's talent shows, I picture it from like Step Brothers when they're singing "Sweet Child of Mine" in the car with Adam Scott.
Absolutely. There you go. No, it was the 8th grade class singing "That's What Friends Are For" and us swaying back and forth.
Oh, what a depressing song. Nice.
I know. It is a depressing song.
Right up there with Frosty the Snowman.
Dude, this show has gone off the rails.
Way off the rails. Let's bring it back because we're going to get back to Dustin Rhodes, so Will get very much on the rails.
Oh, as, yes.
He faced off with Bunkhouse Buck in a Bunkhouse match. Charles, give us a quick history lesson on Bunkhouse Buck. I'm putting you on the spot again. This one I know you're gonna drive a home run over the fence.
Bunkhouse Buck was Jimmy Golden. He was what I mostly know him for. I mean, he worked Alabama a lot. He worked Memphis. He was mostly known for being in a tag team with Robert Fuller or Colonel Parker, his manager here, in the Stud Stable, which was an actual stable in WCW, but was more of a tag team elsewhere. So that's kind of, you know, what I knew him for before he came to WCW. So that's really the background on him. I mean, he was a guy who had a lot of experience, that had been around for a long time, pretty solid worker. This is a great, great, great wrestling match. And you know what? I like it as a contrast to the Cactus Nasty Boys tag, because it's a completely, I mean, they're both brawls, but this is a completely different sensibility, and I thought that was really cool. Dustin Rhodes is also on fire, and it's just such a great baby face in this, just covered in blood and just doing those great comebacks with the jeans and the knee pads and the belts and the powder and the blood. Like, it kind of made me sad because we didn't really see that sort of presentation very often, if at all, after this on a national level. And just, I don't know, it, like, this match more than anything on the show, I think, like, when I was watching this, I just, this is when the show started to really click for it. And I'm like, wow, they've really done a great job putting together the show.
What did you think, Scott?
I love this match. I like Bunkhouse Buck anyway. But Dustin, again, I think really understands, and this is the beginning of his really understanding that we see now with Goldust. I'm glad he lost because I think it continued the kept the feud going. No, it's just a tremendous match that I think made up for the underwhelming Sting Rude match. I think this kind of brought the show back a little bit.
All right, Will.
Man, I'm telling you, there are two types of wrestling I like more than anything. One is kind of like that Regal-esque chess game that we've been talking about throughout the show. And the other is a good, nasty Southern brawl with blood and guts. And with one of my favorite finishes, too. If you can punch somebody in the face and that ends the match, I'm all over it, man. 5 stars. So it's just one of my favorite things. And this also has one of my favorite visuals in wrestling, and that is when a guy is wearing either white trunks or a white shirt and it gets blood stained and you start seeing the splashes of blood over the shirt, and I eat that shit up. And you know, those belt shots were sick, you know, and we're gonna see that again next pay-per-view. The way that they just take off their cowboy boots and start waylaying each other, I'm all over this, man. This is my kind of match right here. Thumbs up. You know, can't say enough good things about it. Mm. And Scott already mentioned, like I said, Dustin coming into his own and stuff. So we're good there. And I want to speak more about that when we get to Bash at the Beach. But yeah, great match. Hello.
Yeah, sorry, I was speaking on mute. I dug it a lot too.
He was singing Nicholas Nichols.
Like, I fucking hate that match. No, it was an awesome match. It really was very, very well done. And for it to stand out on a card that already had a crazy brawl like that, and it's kind of filled with like a kind of a gritty hardcore feel, to stand out on top of all that, I think tells you how good it is. And I think it was Bunkhouse Buck's kind of coming out party. For anyone not familiar with him on the indies, and I mean, a lot of people weren't at this time. It just wasn't prevalent unless you were really just kind of inside or a tape trader or in that area. You didn't know much about him. I mean, me watching this, I had no clue when I was 13 who this guy was. He looked like someone's grandfather coming up to me, you know, when you're 13. And he could fucking go. And he put on a great brawl. And you could tell Dustin, again, just like DDP earlier, taking notes and learning as he goes. I think Dustin was far more advanced than DDP was. But again, taking notes from a guy, a veteran who had worked the business, worked the style of match, and you could see him adapt and play right into it. I thought the best thing he did was play along, sell, help Buck get him over. And I thought he did that beautifully. And, you know, a talent, obviously, given to him, you know, from his dad through birth, is just a natural charisma and a natural ability to get the crowd behind him.
And that's a thing, too, is that Buck is he comes from a wrestling family. He's from the who are the Fuller's partners? Charles, it was the Fullers and the who are the partners? The Fullers and the
I don't know what you're asking. I'm sorry.
The family he comes from.
Rick Fuller.
Nope. It's the
oh, you're asking for who the Fullers are? Is that what you're asking?
No, Jimmy Golden comes from the Welches. So he comes the Welch family. He's from the Welch family, which is like kind of like that whole Alabama territory or whatever. So he's from a wrestling family. Dustin's from a wrestling family. I think that's why they, like you just mentioned, that's where that came from, Justin, is that they come from wrestling families. They know what wrestling's about. That's why they're able to have this kind of match on this show when we've already seen Matt, you know, Matt base matches. We've seen the 15 minute draw. We saw the wanton violence of the tag match. We saw the big popular kind of sports entertainment match with Sting Rude. They're like, okay, we're gonna take this back old school because we know how to work the crowd. So
did you say wanton violence?
I did. What's wrong with that? Makes sense, doesn't it?
Wanton soup.
Yeah, I love it. I just cracked up at that description. Yes.
Oh, God damn it.
Sorry, I got a side of Charles. You guys drew the line. All right, Vader versus the Boss. 9 minutes. A very, very stiff match. After the match, Nick Bockwinkel strips the Boss of his gimmick because he uses the nightstick. And in reality, of course, the WWF was threatening to sue because the character was very similar to the one they owned. And we'll get to where he went after this gimmick ended. I always dug this match. These guys just really beat the piss out of each other. Two guys that really don't seem to care. And this kind of was eye-opening to me. I always liked the Big Boss Man of the WWF. He almost was like a big man finesse worker to me. And it was kind of cool seeing him go out there and just pound the shit out of someone and get pounded. And I felt like you didn't see a lot of that kind of big, heavy blow kind of fight in the WWF. Charles, you agree with that?
Totally agree with that. I wish we saw more stuff like that in the WWF. Right. I love this match. Vader, I think at this point, Vader in 1994, I mean, it was just so good. I don't know that he was capable of having a bad match on pay-per-view. And I think what I really like about Vader during this time is that he tends to bring out a brutal side in people or an aggressive side in people that maybe doesn't always come to the surface. I mean, he did it with Flair in some ways, and now he's doing it with Boss Man. So, yeah, I love this match. It's cool to see guys that big dropping bombs and throwing high spots and, you know, the great suplexes. And
yep.
And I think also for guys that size, they were doing a really fast pace. So I thought this was a lot of fun. It's another example of the variety on the show. I mean, there were so many different types of good matches, and this is just another example.
Always one of my favorite WCW matches growing up. What do you think, Will?
Oh, I love this match too, man. I think you nailed it. And also, man, look at that. Wanton violence, man. I wasn't talking about the fucking dumpling. Okay, sorry. I had to get that out there. Shit.
A lot of MSG with this wanton violence.
Yeah. Christ. But maybe I'm from the South, man. We don't always pronounce things properly, but whatever.
Okay.
But we do have the best type of wrestling.
Hey, we used to have a chat on the show, so we know mispronunciations and screwing things up.
Oh, I didn't say I'm from the dirty South.
Where the big boys play.
Yeah, that's my man. Chad, my man Chris Zellner, who comes on Wrestling with the Past with me and Charles sometimes, man. Love those. I think they're from the same place, right? Georgia? That's that Georgia accent, man. So shout out to Chad and Chris Zellner. But nah, man, this is Charles set up great, man. Just throwing big bombs, man. There's that one like you know which one I'm talking about? Like Boss Man tosses Vader. And just if Vader would have like been like, I don't know, like 4 inches, like at a different angle, he probably would have been paralyzed, man. Just broken his neck, just nasty stuff, you know, and two big dudes beating the shit out of each other, man. That's what wrestling's about.
One thing I want to throw to the group, just because I'm curious, did Harley Race do way too much in Vader matches? I think it's kind of distracting sometimes.
Agreed.
Yeah, that's a good point. I like that, Charles. You're right.
Yeah, well, I mean, sure, but he's Harley Race.
I know. I say it's hard to hate on him because he's Harley, and he does a great job with it. Like it's believable. But I agree that sometimes it was almost like he was with the right guy and the wrong guy. He was like with the right guy because they're both just these big fucking badasses that don't fuck with don't take any shit with anyone. But on the other hand, like Vader didn't need him. Right. I mean, it worked, but he didn't need him. Like, I almost feel like Harley would have been better served with a guy that needed him being a badass.
Imagine
ring
him in, like, Jungle Jim Steel versus the Equalizer. Like, what a added star.
Imagine if he took Thunder Lightning under his wing.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
But yeah,
I think Thunder Lightning might have won that match.
They had Harley throwing headbutts. I agree with you, Charles. I do think sometimes he stepped in a little bit too much. But on the other hand, again, it's Harley. I mean, what are you going to do? I want to get to the main event here because we still got two more shows to get to. But Ric Flair, Ricky Steamboat, Flair's booker is going to go back to his bread and butter coming off their three-match series in 89. They fight here for the world title, ends in a no contest, 32-19, with a double pin. Nick Bockwinkel originally awards the belt to Flair after the match, but later held it up. They'd fight on Saturday night a couple weeks later. Flair would regain the title, put the feud to bed as he was getting ready for the impending debut of Hulk Hogan, who actually plays a little bit of a role in this match, and I kind of liked it. Schiavone on commentary really points out that Steamboat was feeling overshadowed because Hogan, his signing had been teased. I don't know if it was full-on announced at this point. I know they were teasing he was coming in. And they were playing it up as that Steamboat felt like he was getting overlooked. And I thought that was kind of a little bit of reality blending into the storyline here, which I liked. These two guys always had great chemistry. So I'm curious, maybe not as much what you think about the match as a standalone. And Will, we'll start with you. Where does this rank in your Flair Steamboat kind of pantheon pyramid?
Well, it's kind of hard for me to rank them because I like the feud. I like the matchup. I like this match a lot. But Flair Steamboat's one of those feuds I can't watch the matches back to back to back to back. You know, it just they're all like 30 minutes plus. You know, I can't do it, you know. So I think I'm the wrong person to ask that question to, not because I can't rank them. I'm sure if I watched them back to back to back, I could rank them. But because I actually went into this match with the opposite mindset. Don't think about, you know, the Clash match. Don't think about Wrestle War. Don't think about the Meadowlands match. Don't think about, that 1989 series. Just think about what you're watching. You know what I mean? And so I kind of went in with the mindset of exactly what you asked me. Hey, where does it rank? I'm not trying to rank it. You know, I'm just trying to see how I feel about it on this show. So, but I enjoyed it. So, I mean, I enjoyed all their matches, you know, so I'm guessing it would be in the middle. You know, it's, I don't think it's as great as the Clash match or the Steamboat title win, I guess. So I don't know. But I really enjoyed this match as a standalone Flair Steamboat match.
How about the finish?
The finish, I actually, that's kind of like, one of the things that I know some people do not like, I like the finish because it did say, hey, if you're a wrestling fan and we're bringing you this matchup from 5 years ago, if you know your wrestling history, this is a shout out to y'all. And this set up the Saturday night match as well, right? Is that correct?
Yes. Yep.
So it sets up the Saturday night match, which is another kind of stand alone, just watch it in a you know, in a tunnel type match that, you know, I really enjoy. So if you know the history, to me it kind of goes back to that history. Hey, remember when we did this 5 years ago? This one's for you. And if not, for those of y'all that are watching, you know, for the first time watching Flair Steamboat, well, this is going to set up our match on TV. So in that sense, I like the finish, but I kind of liked everything about the match. I like the way that they can just structure a match. I mean, these guys can just structure a great match, and, you know, both of them harp on it. Ah, Flair and I, we just called in the ring. We just see where it goes, and, you know, we don't know what we're going to do until we get in there except for the finish. But you wouldn't know because the matches are structured so well. The only spot I didn't like was, I don't know if y'all remember, there was like a bridge spot, which was a little too choreographed, a little sloppy,
yes,
in the middle. But besides that, man, it's like, man, when you think of like what you know of Flair and Steamboat, just calling it in the ring, not thinking of, well, this is like, you know, a step or two below the Clash match or the Wrestle War match. When you don't have all that other stuff clouding your head and you just watch it with it by itself, man, I thought it was great.
And also get a nice homage too to how equal they are, that they go to a draw here. These two guys are so evenly matched and know each other so well. It's not a surprise they play to a tie. Scott, do you think that played into it as well?
A little bit. I'm how do I word this delicately?
Don't be delicate, man. Be rough.
All right. I didn't like this match compared to the other ones. I didn't like it. I thought it was too slow. I thought there was a lot of walking around, and what was weird is I didn't like Schiavone's commentary here because, remember, during their original run, he wasn't there. He was too busy getting insulted by Jesse Ventura every week on WWF television. So And I hate – I am a stickler for facts, and I'm sure you guys are too. When Steamboat had Flair up in the double chicken and Tony goes, this is how he won the title from Flair back in 1989. No, it wasn't. That was how he got one of the pins at the Clash match.
That's right.
All right. He won the match at Chi-Town Rumble with a crossbody. Get your facts straight, Tony. And stop thinking about Jesse insulting you about shooting a gun and getting disqualified outside a match, the Rude Warrior match at SummerSlam. That's just a separate point. But the match was okay. About 32 minutes was a bit much. I think Flair was asking for more out of this match as a booker than he probably should have. The double pin was a little cheesy, I think. I think this match could have been maybe 10 minutes shorter, and I think it would have been fine. I thought it went a little too long. And the double pin was kind of lame. But again, it was to set up something down the line, obviously.
Scott, let me ask you, if you had seen the matches in 89, and then saw this match in 94 and you saw that pin, wouldn't you think, oh shit, they're doing a callback to the 89 match?
A little bit, yeah. I agree. You know, I agree.
Will, I have to call you out on that because you just said that you tried to block out the 89 series. So how can you...
No. In terms of ranking them, like I didn't want to rank this against the other. I don't. Not talking about the history. I'm talking about like judging it. Okay. I know historically, or I know the reputation. That's what I'm talking about. I'm trying to block out the reputation of the 89 matches being 5 stars versus this one only being like 4 stars or 3 stars. That's okay. What I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the history, you know, of the feud. I'm talking about the actual, like, you know, ranking of the matches. Sorry, I didn't make that clear.
All right. Well, I mean, as a standalone, then I'll say this: it wasn't the worst match. I mean, you're talking about two of the greatest ever, so they're not going to put on a stinker. All right. Well, then I'll word it this way: I think that even still, I was expecting more. Not based on 89, but just because of them. I wasn't crazy about Steamboat in this slot. I may mute in a minute because I feel a sneeze coming on, but I'm just warning you. I think that I just want to say before I just go all over the freaking microphone, but I was getting annoyed at Super Brawl with Steamboat, like, oh, I've been trying to write letters to the board and I really want that. When has Steamboat ever come off as a whiner? And that whole thing irritated me. So I got to be honest, I didn't even like Steamboat. I love Steamboat. And he's even getting booed. And there were points where they were saying, wow, Steamboat's getting kind of booed here. I really didn't even like him in this spot as number one contender, to be honest with you. Maybe that's why I'm looking a little down on this match more than it probably deserves, because I didn't even like him in the number one contender slot.
Yeah, I think the whole, that context, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that pissing and moaning at Super Bowl, I've been trying to write letters. And I think, come on, Rick, you've never done that before. Now you're crying about title shots. That's not like him. So I was, and particularly Flair being kind of a babyface too, you know, it was just really weird. Why can't Flair just say, all right, you want a title shot? I'll give it to you. No, we got to go through letter writing. I mean, what the hell? It was stupid. I don't know. The whole thing irritated me, but I don't want to, I guess the whole point, Will, you're right. I don't want to take away from the match itself. It was good. Not as good as I anticipated, but I think I was going in with the whole, I really don't feel like seeing another Steamboat Flair match because I don't think the context of this match being put together was what I was hoping for. I was hoping for another number one, maybe somebody, an up-and-comer, maybe even a kind of a Flair-Rude, unification, something like that.
Yeah.
And Flair was still a face. So, and then maybe have Sting kind of announce, and you know, you can give him this match off, this night off, or have him face somebody else. I don't know. Have him face Austin for the U.S. title. I don't know. But I think it would have been more well suited to have it set up something with Sting than to have another Steamboat match that I feel was almost shoehorned in just because Flair wanted it. I don't know. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, I agree with the criticisms, actually, even though I do think this is a great match. But I also think it's a great match with both guys in their comfort zone. And, you know, that's not a huge criticism because even in their comfort zone, you're going to get something good. But it feels a little bit behind the times of where wrestling was in 1994. And what I mean is that a lot of things like Flair, like telling the referee to watch the tights and then sneaking in a closed fist, like those are things that got great heat in their 89 series. But by 94, the rules aren't really being presented as something important in the presentation in the same way. And it, to me, I like the match actually kind of works as a commentary because it's kind of tragic in some ways because they are doing a lot of detailed things that I really love, but time has passed them by in some ways because wrestling sadly has not really emphasized a lot of those things in a long time. I mean, I liked it when Steamboat went up top and did the top rope superplex because that was like something that was kind of new and fresh for the series. But I don't know, like Dustin Bunkhouse Buck and Vader Boss, I don't know that either match was as good as this in terms of like actual wrestling, but both matches seemed a lot more contemporary. And I mean, I don't know, you could say that the style, the wrestling style was kind of dumbed down in between the 89 series and the 94 series. And some of the things that would have gotten a better reaction 5 years before this just didn't get that same reaction in 1994. So, I mean, it's because I don't want to complain about the quality of the match that they gave us, but I also think that these guys were considered like the torchbearers. And so there is a certain expectation from them, even when they're older and maybe a little bit past their peak. And this just felt like a throwback match, like a nostalgia match, instead of something that was relevant to what was going on.
That's an awesome segue into Slamboree, man.
And that segue is going to have to wait. Because what we're going to do is we're going to wrap right now, and we're going to make everyone come back tomorrow night with part two. And this is going to be part one, because I think we got a lot left to cover. I don't want to shoehorn it in. I don't want to make the file too long. So why don't we pause here. We'll wrap things up, Scott. We'll come back, and with part two, we'll have Will and Charles here. We'll do Slamboree, Bash of the Beach, and kind of take a holistic view of the first half of 1994. So, for Will and Charles and Scott, I'm Justin Rosero. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow night with part two.
Dip in the melodic sea. Rhythm keeps flowing, it drips the MC. Sweet sugar pop, rocks and pop. You don't stop till the sweet beat drops. I shall improve as I stick and move. Vivid poems recited on top of the groove. Smooth mind, floating like a butterfly. Notes set afloat, sung like a lullaby. Brace yourself as the beat hits ya. Dip, trip, hit Fantasia. And hip hop dripping in your dome makes your zone and bop. Funk infusion, a fly illusion keeps you coasting on the rhythm you're cruising. Up, down, round and round, rhymes profound, but nevertheless you got to get down. Fantasy freak through the beat so unique, you move your feet and sweat from the heat. Back to the fact, I'm the Mac and I know that the way I keep the rhyme, someone call me a poet. Poem steady flowing, growing, showing sights and sound. Caught in the groove, invitation I'm found. Many tripped and tore upon the rhymes they soared to an infinite height, to the realm of the hardcore. Here we go, off I take ya, dip trip, flip Fantasia. Jump to the jam, boogie woogie jam slam. Bust the dialect, I'm the man in command. Come flow with the sounds of the mighty mic master. Rhyming on the mic, I'm bringing suckers to disaster. Buku ducks, but I still rock Nike. With the razzle dazzle, a star I might be. Scribble, dribble, scrabble on the microphone. I babble as I fix the funky words into a puzzle. Yes, 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 on and on as I flex. Get with the flow, birds manifest. Feel the vibe from here to Asia. Dip trip.